The following audio presentation is brought to you by the Australian Institute of Family Studies as part of our monthly seminar series in which we showcase national and international research related to the family. The seminars are designed to promote a forum for discussion and debate. They are open to the public and free of charge.
Thank you very much. Well, it's a real pleasure and privilege to be here. I'm in Australia for about 12 days. But with all respect, the other place that I've been to be here at AAFES is certainly the academic highlight. This institution has a worldwide reputation, and of course it's a very cosmopolitan city, and I think of this institution as being related to institutions in Boston, London, and Zurich. It's related to MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is a world leader in research. And also, now you may know, you can go look on the internet and see any of its research, and its classes are posted on the internet, so it's extremely accessible. I think of AAFES as also related to what goes on in Zurich, in that this place sets the gold standard for research. We look all around the world to AAFES for real leadership. And then I also think of it a bit as related to things that go on in London, and particularly the Star Chamber. And I've been warned that your questions at the end will be very intense, and I should prepare myself. And I'm certainly happy to engage in discussion with you at the end. And I should say, I think, as will hopefully become clear, I know a fair bit about alienation. And at the end, I've citation to some articles I've written and co-authored, as well as to a book that's forthcoming. This is a bit of a promotional tour, perhaps. But I'm also going to be talking about Australia. And if you think that I don't know much about Australia, well, you're right, I'm out of my hemisphere, and you can certainly discount what I'm saying, or at least correct what I'm saying about Australia. But one of the things that I've done in preparation for coming here is undertake a little study of Australian cases dealing with alienation, and I'll talk about that. And I should say I'm giving you the outline of that. I've also sent to Daryl and to AAFES a shorter paper that will give more details. So those two are researchers that are going on questions, and you can say, well, I want to see more data. There actually is more data that I'm going to be able to talk about in the next hour. So I'm going to talk first about the concepts involved here, alienation, but distinguishing that from concepts like justified rejection and so-called hybrid cases, talk about why alienation is very important for children, for families, for the court system. Then look and see and talk about how the courts respond to alienation cases, particularly looking a little bit at Australia and then having some comparison to what is being done in some other places. And then I'll have some conclusions focusing a little bit on law reform issues and how the system might be changed to improve how alienation cases are dealt with, including talking briefly about some of the developments in Canada and the United States about how so there are some innovative programs for dealing with alienation cases. Although I want to say that in no way are other countries ahead of Australia. These are very challenging issues everywhere. I've given versions of this presentation at a number of places in the United States and in England as well. And in some ways, I think Australia is ahead of some other countries, as challenging as these cases are. I should say I was out in Perth and gave versions of this presentation last week, and we'll be going on to Sydney and talking about it there as well. It's a very broad spread concern among professionals, parents, administrators, and so on, mental health professionals. So what are some of the concepts here? And part of this is that alienation cases or cases where children are resisting contact with one parent are an aspect of high conflict separations. They're not the only situation of high conflict separations, and as I'll discuss, there are certainly many cases where parents are having a lot of anger, hostility towards one another, where children are not resisting contact with a parent. But there are also cases in which children where the high conflict is reflected and reinforced by the issues around contact or visitation with both parents. But thinking about high conflict cases in general, one of the things, of course, that I'm sure everyone in this room is familiar with, that most people who separate, there's always some level of anger, hostility, loss of trust, and so on. But most people can resolve their issues fairly with a limited amount of contact. sometimes not involving professionals at all, particularly if they haven't had children. They may just separate without any involvement or little involvement of the legal system. There is a significant portion that has some involvement, particularly maybe getting go through mediation, resolve their disputes. They may go and see lawyers, have their matters negotiated, but they're not really going through the court system or going through in a very limited way. But there's a significant population, and depending on how you define it, could be as many as a third of all separations that have higher levels of conflict, higher levels of disagreement, more court visits, more intensity, and often more emotional stress for the children involved. And if you take the study, say, well, it's about a third of cases at the time of separation, that gradually, many of those people gradually, their anger, their conflict tends to dissipate over time. But there is a subgroup of 10 or 15% that remain high conflict for years and years afterwards. And these cases are particularly concerning to the justice system in that they take up a lot of time and energy. In North America refer to them as frequent flyers. I mean, they're coming back to court a lot. But more seriously, I think one of the concerns is that these are cases that are particularly emotionally disturbing for and physically disturbing for children in terms of their long-term outcomes. I'll be talking a little bit about them. One of the issues is, I've talked about alienation. Alienation is part of a broader set of issues where children are not visiting with one of the parents. And for the first few minutes, I'm going to, just to make it simpler, assume it's the father they're not seeing, which is often the case, but as I'll discuss, it can be mothers as well. But the idea, of course, that in Australia you have particularly strong legislation that emphasizes the rights of children to have a relationship with both parents. But if they're not seeing one of the parents, often it is emotionally unhealthy. On the other hand, it's important to think, at least from a conceptual and policy point of view, that sometimes seeing both parents is not particularly in the interest of children and in terms of their emotional well-being, particularly when the conflict is very high, if the parenting of the other parent who's not being seen is not very strong. One could say, is it really in the child's interest to see both parents? That's at least a live issue conceptually. Now, the law may have a different view and say, no, you're going to see both your parents. But if our concern is emotional well-being, we have to ask the question of, is contact always in the interest of children? That's something that I'll come back to, and I'm sure we'll have some discussion about. Now, thinking about the problems of children resisting visitation with one parent, divorce, the history of the family, of course, goes back thousands of years, well before recorded time. History of divorce is relatively recent, so starting in the until the middle of the 19th century, at least in countries with an English heritage, there was no divorce. But gradually, the concept of divorce developed, and almost as soon as it did, almost as soon as society allowed parents to separate, there were issues around one parent alienating not allowing the child to see the other parent. There was a famous case in England, Lady Caroline's case, where a very abusive man forced his wife out and then refused to let her see the children. That resulted in legislation. By 1900, there were people talking about children having poisoned minds, that was the term they used, and not wanting to see one of the parents because their mind had been poisoned. But a key sort of set of developments here came with the work of an American psychiatrist, Dr. Richard Gardner, who developed the concept of parental alienation syndrome. And I think his work was very important for reasons that I can certainly get into. I think in some ways it was certainly significant that he identified the issue. I think some of his both analysis and recommendations were problematic. And for reasons I'll talk about, it's probably not best to refer to this as a syndrome. But Gardner certainly has had both an important role, and he's a controversial figure because some of his recommendations, I think, are problematic. So his ideas were reformulated in 2001 by Janet Johnson and Joan Kelly, two American psychologists. I should say Janet Johnson, of course, is an Australian, but she's spent many years living in the United States. They claim her as one of their own, but as soon as you hear her speak, you'd say, we know where she's from. And they, first of all, much of my presentation builds on their formulation and their work. They point out that it's not a syndrome. First of all, technically it's not a syndrome because it hasn't been accepted by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for or there's, you may know there's a revision going on. It's not going to, my understanding is it will not be in the next one as well. But more significantly, it's not a syndrome because a mental health professional can't diagnose somebody saying this child has parental alienation syndrome. It is a relationship that exists between children and parents. It exists in a range of different contexts. And one of the problems is if you say, well, somebody has a syndrome, you write it in their file. So you say, this person has depression, this person, so do we want to label children? Or for that matter, is it the parents? We'd say, who has the syndrome anyway? So there are probably good reasons not to call it a syndrome. Having said that, certainly parental alienation exists, and there are alienated children. I'll be talking about that. I certainly think that the discovery of alienation by Gardner, really, I think was very important, at least in part because it heightened awareness. There's no doubt that there were problems with contact, visitation, access throughout the century, but no one was really, it was given little attention by the courts and by professionals and by parents. The fact that there was the discovery, if you want, of the concept of alienation helped people put a name on something that had been going on. And it certainly, therefore, it heightened professional awareness to this. It heightened the awareness of parents, and I think that ultimately educating parents is often going to be the most important response in many of the cases. It's also helped develop research. The fact that we now have a concept means that people are doing research. Later on, and I have references, I just participated in a review of all the published research about alienation. There are about 39 empirical studies. And certainly the fact we have a concept helps us understand how to identify it and how to respond to it. There's certainly a great need for more research in this area, both in terms of identification, developing responses, knowing what works, and so on. And Australian courts at one point were saying, well, we shouldn't call this parental alienation syndrome. They've recognized that. There were some judges that said maybe we shouldn't talk about parental alienation at all. But I think it's clear that today Australian courts are using the word parental alienation. So if one does a search on the database, one finds a lot of cases using the term parental alienation, and I think appropriately. Having said that, certainly there's a concern. If you say there's alienation going on, does that heighten conflict? Would it be better to use some other kind of terminology, particularly if you're in a professional context? My own view is that it's actually like domestic violence or domestic abuse. We used to just say, well, the couple weren't getting along. There was a bit of argy-bargy. No, I think if someone is being a victim of assault, spousal abuse, we call it spousal abuse, as we should. If there's parental alienation going on, we should call it that and tell people it's not acceptable conduct, and we'll talk about how to address that. So Kelly and Johnson and others have developed this idea that the key issue is this, well, there are two key things. One is, has parental alienating behavior gone on? And I'm going to talk about parental alienating behavior in a moment. But the key issue from a clinical point of view and a legal point of view is this a child who is not seeing a parent who's resistant or rejecting visitation because the child is freely and persistently expressing unreasonable negative feelings and beliefs such as anger, hatred, rejection, and or fear toward a parent that is disproportionate to their actual experience with that parent. And so, again, the paradigmatic situation, children had a good relationship with both parents when they were living together. Parents separate. Often visitation will be going on for a few years, and then all of a sudden or quite quickly, one child or the sibling group says, we don't want to see Dad anymore. We hate Dad. Dad is terrible. He's terrible. His house smells. His pets are awful. His parents are awful. And when you actually try to unpack what's been going on, it's not based on the child's experiences with that parent. It is reflecting the attitudes that are coming from an alienating parent. But at the other end of the spectrum, there is what we refer to as justified, what I refer to as justified rejection. There's another term, estrangement is also used. There are a range of terms, but saying some children don't want to see their parent, let's say their dad, because of his conduct towards them. And in the most dramatic cases, you have children who've been sexually abused, and you can clearly find they've been sexually abused. They're afraid of Dad. They don't want to see Dad. And we can call that justified rejection. It certainly the sexual abuse case are the most dramatic. There can be domestic violence going on, poor parenting. In some cases, it's a context of step-parent issues. There may be a new step-blended family, and siblings in that family are rejecting or being really mean to or whatever, emotionally abusive to the child, and they say, I don't want to see that family, so I don't want to see dad, but he's always with those other people who aren't very nice to me. So there's justified, so you have to sort of unpack it. And then recognizing that there, if your alienation and justified rejection are two poles, many cases are somewhere in the middle, in that both parents probably have some responsibility, or there may be a sort of a vicious spiral. Some of you may be familiar, for example, with the situation with Alec Baldwin, the American actor. As I tell you, this will come back to you. So Alec Baldwin, a famous American actor, is married to Kim Basinger, a famous American actress. They have a 13-year-old daughter. He's in New York, and she's in Los Angeles. And he's able to, he has telephone contact with her as well as going to visit. And he's supposed to phone every night at 6 o'clock in Los Angeles. So he picks up the phone. She won't answer. And finally, he leaves her this message saying, you know, you little pig, you're so selfish, you little pig. You don't know what, you know, and he, as you, you must have heard that. How many of you heard that recording? She, of course, recorded it. And this would be an example of, there probably was some alienation going on. The mother was sort of pushing the daughter away. But instead of responding, calmly and appropriately, dad overreacts and makes the situation worse. So you can say there's some conduct of both parents. So you have to look at what both parents are doing. Now, the key issue is the child alienated? But another aspect of this is, what about the behavior of the parents? And it is common in high conflict situations that one or both parents are engaging in what can be characterized as parental alienating behavior. That is to say, they are undermining the relationship with the other child. And often this is just verbal. They're bad-mouthing each other. It may be conscious. It may be unconscious. A mother may think that the children are, you know, playing somewhere, and she's on the phone talking to her mother and saying, well, you know what that guy did, and so on. So there, she's saying things and about bad things about the father, and the children overhear it. In other cases, it's much more direct. You really don't want to go and see your dad. He's a real SOB. Fathers certainly engage in this kind of conduct. Your mom's a slut, and so on. So a lot of denigrating of the other parent. And then there's sort of a spectrum of more serious conduct or more intense conduct. Children may, for example, be asked to report back. Well, what is your mom doing? Does she have a new boyfriend? Some of the situations and children get into a situation where they realize that when they've gone to visit dad, they have a great time, they go out to the park and everything. If they come back and tell mom I've had a great time, mom sort of makes them feel bad, so they don't say what it was. And that actually then leads into a bit of a cycle, in that they realize mom wants to hear how bad it was, so they, you know, their case where they had a great time with dad, he's fed them well, and they get home and mom says, how was it? Oh, it was terrible, dad didn't feed me. So they, oh, dad's not feeding you. Well, that's, you know, we got to do something about that. And you get into this misunderstanding cycle. There's also an issue of false empowerment, in that the child is told, well, you have the right to see your father if you want to, but that means you also have the right not to see your father. So if you don't want to see your father, I won't make you do that. It's up to you, dear. Whatever you want to do is fine with me. Well, the message is, kids say, okay, I don't want to see that. And sometimes maybe they don't want to see that, or they want to see their friends. But sometimes they say, this is what mom wants. And mom wouldn't say that about other situations. Mom doesn't say, if you don't get along in school, you don't have to go to school. She said, well, let's try to deal with that problem. And then there are situations of false allegation. I'll talk more about that. When there is, of course, scheduled time for visitation, mom can be very supportive and say, I know you're going off, have a great time with your dad. I've arranged to see, you know, do some work this weekend, or I'm going to see my friends. And when you get back, we'll have a good time. Mom can say, well, you're going to see your dad this weekend, but this is the weekend that I'll be going off with my new boyfriend to have a wonderful time camping, so I guess you're going to miss that, and that kind of. And there's nothing wrong with mothers doing things when the kids aren't around, but I actually sort of emphasize to the children what they're missing is the problem. The other side of this is when we talk about alienating behavior by the parents is that this is a characteristic of high conflict situations. Often it may be a situation where there is initially not a bad relationship, and then it becomes worse. One of the things that happens is that there's a developmental component to alienation, in that younger children can go back and forth between parents who may be very hostile towards one another without being alienated. So that with mom, their parents separate when the kid is four. When the kid is six, the kid's going back and forth. When he's with mom, mom says, dad is terrible. The kid says, yes, dad is terrible. He gets in the car, goes off with dad, and dad says, mom is terrible. He says, yes, mom is terrible. The kids can go back and forth. They can split their lives up in a way because they don't have fully integrated personalities. And so they're not, they remember, but they can just sort of shift back and forth. But as they get older, as they get towards adolescence, they have a more integrated personality, and they have trouble doing that going back and forth. Now, I want to say there are many children who live in high-conflict situations where both parents are engaging in alienating conduct, and they nevertheless continue to see both parents. It's emotionally stressful for them, but parental alienation, alienating behavior does not always lead to an alienated child. They're related, but it's not a one-to-one relationship. So people, just like you could be out in the street exposed to some kind of germs and you don't get sick, somebody else does. But it's partly age-related, it's partly temperament-related. There may be issues about sibling groups. So there are several siblings and one of them becomes alienated and then starts to affect the oldest one, typically will start to affect the younger one. One of the issues I'm going to come back and talk about it more is the issue of the relationship between spousal abuse and alienation. There are certainly some abusive spouses, particularly men, who may be both physically abusive to their former spouses or emotionally abusive and also very controlling to the children. They will be alienating the children. So it's not always by any means only moms who alienate children. It can often be dads, sometimes abusive dads. The other thing is I'm going to talk about this more is that alienation is to some extent related to personality disorders. How many of you have heard the concept of personality disorder? Okay, about half of you have. This is a mental health concept. Very briefly, this is not a mental disorder. This is not like depression or whatever. But it's a personality trait in about 10% of the population that they can function well in society and so on. But they have a distorted sense of reality in certain kinds of situations. And, I mean, there's a large, huge literature about personality disorder. But from a lawyer's point of view, and I'm a lawyer, not a mental health professional, this is a way of saying that there's about 10% of the population that is not reasonable. And so sometimes there's a book written. Are there any mediators here? Anyone engaged in mediation? There are a few mediators. There's been books written about mediation. One of the nice things, a book called Mediation, the Rational Alternative. Great, and it is a rational alternative. For many people, the best way to settle their family disputes is by way of mediation. The problem is there's about 10% of the population that are unreasonable, and they can't have their disputes mediated or shouldn't have their disputes mediated. And it's not probably a coincidence that about 10% of the population is personality disorder, and about 10% of cases end up in the court system, and there's a high overlap there between the two things. The significance of this is that these are people who are going to be difficult to educate out of it, to be say, look, it's not good for your child, and so on. And there are certainly disproportionately large number of parents involved in these cases who are personality disorder. And they're, of course, very difficult clients to deal with. So those of you who are professionals, for example, if you're not familiar with the literature about personality disorder, you should become familiar with it. Say, sometimes the issue here is the client, litigant, whatever. So I was saying that, you know, there is a range of reasons why children don't see their parents. Sometimes it would be one of the things is part of normal development. So at a very young age, a 18-month-old child, for example, is with mom, living with mom, but there's going to be contact with dad every, you know, once a week or whatever. And when dad comes, the child is crying and clinging on to mom and says, mom says, he's so terrified of leaving me. He won't, you know, it must be that dad is doing something. No, in fact, this is, and then dad saying, what has mom been saying to the child? With children of that age, it's normal if they've been living primarily with one person that they have separation anxiety when they go to another. And in fact, if you're an intact family, when you drop your kids at daycare, they're sitting there crying. You think, oh, this is going to be terrible. And they let you sort of look around the window, you see they settle down after about 60 seconds and they're just fine. So there's a good interesting developmental question, but people misunderstand that. Another thing that can happen, and certainly as children grow older, is that they may have a stronger identification with one parent or the other. And they may say, well, I'm playing soccer and I really want to be with dad. He's the soccer coach. I like mom. I'm not resisting contact with mom, but I see less of her. Mom says, well, why isn't he spending time? The reality is, as he's a teenager, he's spending less time with both parents, but especially spending time with one parent. And then there's certainly the issues about issues of genuine abuse. And the other thing to realize is there are a lot of situations in which children are not seeing one parent because that parent has dropped out of the child's life. And there's a temptation, I think, for some, particularly it's been fathers, who they separate, they have a new relationship, they may move away, and they don't see much of their kids. And rather than saying, you know, I wasn't a great dad, I sort of love them, but I don't go back there very much, to say, well, you know, it was mom's fault, I was alienated from the kids, so I don't see them. But was, in fact, whose fault was, and in many of those cases, mom is actually really supportive and saying, I wish he would see more of the kids. And then, as I mentioned, there are these mixed cases where you have, and it can be hard to tell exactly what's going on, in that both parents are feeding into this cycle, and one of the questions is, how is the parent who's being rejected responding and reacting to that situation? One of the major issues here about alienation is what the negative effects of alienation and why we're concerned about this as a society. And there's a growing body of literature that identifies a range of negative emotional behavioral outcomes for children who are involved in serious alienation cases, particularly because often the alienating parent, assuming it's the mother, is personality disorder, and so she may not be a terrific parent. There's a concept of enmeshment. She may become have a very too inappropriately close relationship with the child. Child distorts the child's sense of reality. It's not just that children are losing the benefit of seeing, let's say, dad, but also they're spending and having an inappropriate relationship with mom. The other thing is, if mom is sitting there saying, you know, your dad's really a terrible person, you shouldn't see him, and the child is sort of thinking, well, I'm half dad and half mom, what does that make me? And so it affects children's self-image, it affects their behavior, and so on. So there are a lot of issues about the negative effects of alienation. And there's a growing body of research about this, and this is not perfect research, there's always methodological questions, but one such study that came out in a book is by Amy Baker, who is an American psychologist. This study, by the way, is not without methodological problems. It's true of every single study in this area. There's no perfect research here, but she found a number of people who, as young adults, had a very poor relationship with one parent, and she went back and said, well, asked as young adults, what was going on in your childhood. One of the things I think that was very revealing was many of them said, I said when I was a kid, I didn't want to see dad. These were almost all kids who didn't see dad. I wish that dad and or the court had ignored me and not given effect to my wish. I was saying it, but I didn't really feel it. I wish that I'd been ignored. And then she also found that these people had a disproportionately large number of problems, depression, drug and alcohol abuse, and so on, which suggests that there are negative effects from alienation in and of itself, as well as the loss of the relationship with the other parent. We don't really know how common this problem is. There's a range of different estimates. It's certainly a significant problem. Some people say it's as much as 1% of children. That sounds 1% of all children, not just divorced children. I think that's probably a little bit high. But it's certainly a significant portion of children who are involved in the family justice system have some aspect of alienation. So this is certainly a significant social problem in terms of its effects on children. And then it also has, of course, an element of what I can call gender politics, in that gender-based groups have seized on alienation or rejected it. So there are some feminist groups that are highly critical of alienation, and some feminist authors said alienation doesn't exist. The only reason that children don't want to see dad is because dad's been abusive. And there are certainly cases where that happens. But I don't think that's the only thing that's going on. On the other side, there are some fathers groups who say every time a child doesn't want to see dad, it's because of mom's alienation. And another point that is made by fathers, and I think this is a fair one, is as a society, Australia, like Canada, enforces child support. We say if you separate, you have an obligation to pay child support. I know here you have an agency, there's controversy about it and so on, but they say you don't pay your support, the state is going to come after you and make sure you, you know, seize your bank account or garnish your wages or whatever. The other side of it is they say, well, if dad doesn't get to see the kids, what happens? Well, he has to hire a lawyer or go to court and so on, and the state seems to take, at best, often the justice system is not aggressive or aggressive enough in dealing with this situation, and it's a fair criticism of those who are denied access to contact with their children say, why is the state making me pay but not ensuring that I see my child? So that's a fair criticism commentary. So I want to shift now to what's been going on in the courts. How do courts deal with these issues of resistance to contact? So one of the things is we did a study, and the methodology is explained on your webpage. It's not unproblematic. I know if you're a social science researcher, but what we did is we looked at for cases in Australia on the Austlii database and the Western Australia database. I should say it's sort of interesting. Coming, you know, I'm sure when you're here looking over at Canada, you think of, Canada and the United States are pretty close. Maybe it's all one country and get confused that way. And so when we're in Canada and we look over and see Western Australia, and we think it's part of Australia. But when you get there, you find out maybe it's not. I don't know. And they were very nice out there, but they actually have a different. I didn't discover this until we were doing the research. They don't have their. You have Austlii for legal research. You have all the Australian cases on one database. It says this is all the cases in Australia, and then somewhere there's a tiny footnote, except for Western Australia, which has its own completely separate database. Anyway, we looked at both the database and found a bunch of cases, probably all the cases that mentioned parental alienation, but. These are, if you want, the tip of the iceberg for a variety of reasons. It's a sample of cases, probably hopefully a representative sample, but there are many, many more cases in absolute numbers. A small subsample gets reported. But this graph, as you can see, suggests that there's been a significant, really substantial increase in the number of parental alienation cases that are before the courts. And I should say, very similar kind of time trends in Canada and in the United Kingdom. We've done similar studies. So what you find is there's, and I'm not saying there's more of this going on, but there's certainly more awareness of this, and it's more labeling of it in Australia as elsewhere. Now, one of the questions, of course, is until now I've been saying, well, it's assuming it's mother who alienates the kids and father who is the alienated parent. What this graph shows you, and similar results in other jurisdictions, although you probably have a little closer gender relationship here. The red are the ones where alienation was claimed and found. And so you find that, yes, mothers do alienate children more than fathers, somewhat more. There it's 20 to 15. But there are also a significant number of cases, a very significant number, where alienation is claimed, but the judge says, you know what, I see the child is not visiting, but this is not alienation. This is justified rejection or a mixed case or whatever. So alienation is a subcategory, clearly a subcategory of all cases where there are contact problems, and fathers are significantly more likely to make these kind of unfounded claims than mothers. And having said that, it's mothers who do more alienation. Really, when you break it down, really it's the people who have residency of children or shared residence who are doing alienation. There is a little chunk up there. There are certainly some parents who only have contact or seeing the kids, every two or three or four days out of 14. But most alienation occurs by the residential parent or a situation of shared residence, which when you think about it makes sense. What's in some extent often happening is the child sees there's this war going on between these two people. I have to choose sides. And you tend to choose sides with the person who you're spending most of the time with. That's not the only dynamic, but that is one explanation of what's on it. And this, by the way, is replicated in research from other countries. There's no question that the more time you spend with somebody, the more likely you are to be able to alienate the children. And, of course, this tends to skew towards fathers as being the alienated parent. Now, in Australia, as in other jurisdictions, you have recognition of the rights of, and you used the word correct, I think, it's the right of the child to have a relationship with both parents. And I think rights rhetoric here is useful. That's what your legislation says. But I would caution those of you who are in a professional context, if you start saying, well, it's the child's right to see the other parent, that quickly becomes an alienating parent saying, well, if the child has the right to see the other parent, it's the child's right. Part of an exercising the right is you have the right not to see the other parent. And so they say the reason that my son is not seeing his dad is because it's his right to do that. I'm supporting his rights. And that rhetoric, therefore, can be somewhat problematic. I tend to prefer, and it's been restated in other places, including the Australian High Court, saying, well, what's going on here legally is that parents have an obligation to ensure that the child has a relationship with the other parent. Say both parents have that obligation, but particularly the residential parent has that obligation. When these cases come to court, of course, there's an initial significant issue here. Why is the child not seeing the parent? Is it alienation? Is it rejection? And then trying to compare the parenting capacities of both parents. In these cases, there's a significant incidence of unfounded allegations of sexual abuse. I'll talk about that. This, by the way, is a context in which there's a particularly high incidence of unfounded allegation of sexual abuse, different from almost every other context, and almost always coming from a parent. Certainly there's expert witnesses. I'll talk about that. Family consultants are important. And there are issues about the child's perceptions and wishes and so on. So I'll look at a few of these things. First of all, to go back, less than half the cases the courts found alienation where it was claimed. So slightly less than half. That means there are a lot of cases where the judge is saying, yes, I hear that visitation is not occurring, but it's not because of alienation. It's because of justified estrangement due to abuse or due to poor parenting. Sometimes it's just the judge saying, you know what, this kid, he wants to see both the parents, but not as much as you both want to. He's disengaging as he's getting older, or saying, I'm not sure what is going on. And then mentioned sexual abuse allegations. This is a pretty dramatic of a small sample. We found 74 reported cases. One-fifth of the case, there was an allegation of sexual abuse. And of those, in that one-fifth, 80% the judge said there was no sexual abuse. So you have a high incidence of sexual unfounded allegations. I want to emphasize that many of these are not, most of them, and certainly it's not coming from the child, it's typically moms, but sometimes dads making it about stepfathers. Often, I think, misinterpreting, misunderstanding what's going on. I can certainly talk about that in the discussion. And again, this kind of data is replicated in other jurisdictions as well. And of course, when it's going on, it can be highly emotionally damaging to the child, and the child's being taken to a doctor to investigate. The doctor says, well, I'm not sure. I don't think there's no evidence here. Mom says, well, let's go to another doctor. Let's go to somebody else. And sometimes the children come to believe the allegations. And, of course, there are cases where the judge may say, I'm not sure what's happening. And, of course, there are cases where it is actually sexual abuse. So it's not that it's never true. The question is, it's a high incidence. Another question here is the role of family consultants, of single experts. And I think in Australia you have the dominant model of bringing expert evidence before the court is the single expert family consultant. How many of you are family consultants or single experts here? So a few of you. And one of the things that's very clear is from reading the cases, your evidence is given very significant weight in these cases. In over 80% of the cases, the judge says, the family consultant says there's alienation. I accept that, and I'm going to accept their recommendation. But by no means always, and sometimes the expert is not sure what is happening. And this is certainly an area where there's a need for more education of experts as well. Whole set of issues about family violence as well. There's no question that there are cases where a child doesn't want to see the parent because of domestic violence. Although, interestingly, if there's not alienation going on, children usually want to see both parents, even if there's been abuse going on, physical or sexual abuse. So in the child protection context, children may be abused, they still want to see their parents. So when they say, I never want to see dad ever again, that probably tells them it may be more than abuse. Having said that, there's no question that there are situations, and your new legislation, I think, appropriately emphasizes saying, there are situations where there's a significant concern about domestic violence, and that's a reason not to allow visitation to occur, even if the child's saying they want it. Or they may say, look, it's very distressing for the child because the child's witnessed violence and so on. There's clearly an overlap here with these concerns that makes them more complex to deal with. Another set of issues here is about what do we about hearing from children. And my own view is that it's really important for children in all contexts, including alienation cases, to know that they've been heard. That doesn't mean that we're going to do what they say, I mean, we in the court system or otherwise, but children should have a voice and not a choice. In my own view, and this is something I've talked about elsewhere in Australia and we get into the discussion, this would include in some cases meeting with the judge. That's not instead of family consultants or instead of lawyers, but saying, you know what, the child has strong views here. Let the child in, and the child wants to. Let the child meet the judge. And I don't, there's a question about training judges. I think the judges, their main message is, I think, saying, I'm going to hear from you, but I want to know it's not your decision. It's my responsibility. So, yes, tell me what you think, and I will decide. You don't have to be burdened by this. That's a long and ongoing story. Having said that, if the judge concludes this is an alienation case, and often they're quite easy to identify when you're meeting with the kid, the wishes are clearly not determinative. So this is one quote from, and there are many cases in Australia that say this thing. Here we have children, they're 10 and 11. They say that they want to live with dad, they never want to see mom, but I think that, you know, mom has been, that their rejection of mom is a result of the influence of dad, who's often been abusive, and I'm not going to accept their wishes. I'm going to order that they continue to see mom a significant period of time. To show you the complexity of these cases, this is a case I was out in Western Australia, and I said, well, isn't this a great decision here? You know, your chief justice said this, and he understood the dynamics, and they said, oh, yes. Well, 2 years later, the kids ended up back with dad, notwithstanding the fact the court makes an order, and they stopped seeing mom. The judge tried to make another order, and then dad wrote a threatening email to the judge. Dad was charged with threatening a judge and so on, and but the kids are still with dad, and the alienation is still going on. So they're very difficult cases to deal with. Now, when thinking about how to deal with alienation or contact problems, or perhaps any other high conflict problem, there are really two approaches that one can have in terms of the justice system. On the one side, they're saying, let's try to reduce the conflict. Let's try to mediate. Let's try to settle. And the other side is, let's go to court. Let's have judges make an order. And those are two alternatives, but you can try both of them at once. In fact, one of the problems, I think, in Australia is you tend to sequence them. So you spend a huge amount of time trying to mediate and so on. And they say, if mediation fails, we'll get to court. And there's a good reason in most cases for doing that, but I think in alienation cases, there's a good argument for getting to court more quickly. And I'll talk about that, that you're too slow to have a coercive legal response. That doesn't mean most people should be going to court, but it does mean you have to identify these cases. And, of course, similarly, domestic violence cases. If there's domestic violence going on, mediation may not be appropriate, and you're starting to recognize that as well. So on the one side, you can say, well, can we help these people to have a better relationship and understand what they're doing to their children? And most parents, not all parents, but if you start to educate them and say, you know, think about what you're doing, you know, to your child, and you sort of summarize some of this literature and so on, say, don't you, and most parents say, do you want your child to have a good relationship with the other parent? Yes, of course. Well, realize that you have to support that. It actually takes an active effort on your part. And then there are things that we can do to help, maybe we can do role playing and so on, to educate you to be a better parent. And most people will change in that situation. And I should say lawyers can have a role in this. Lawyers for parents say, what are you doing to help support the relationship with the other parent? Having said that, there's a subgroup of people, particularly those who are personality disorder, from whom education is not going to be very effective. They say, well, I understand that's true in general, but I'm one of the cases where it's terrible for them to have the relationship. And so you need the coercive response either to get these people to engage in education or to allow contact to occur notwithstanding their abuse. I think the judges have a really important role in these cases, and fortunately, largely in Victoria and elsewhere, you have what we refer to as case management, the docket system, so that when a case comes before a judge, that judge keeps control of that case. That's not always true here in Australia.
It's common in Australia.
It's common, but not enough. All right. And so in Canada, I'd say it's starting to happen. We need it more. So you're ahead of us. But you definitely, I think, for these parents in particular, case management, docket management, control by one judge is incredibly important, because these are very manipulative people, and they'll try this out on different judges. So having that continuity is really important. And judges have a role, I think, in educating parents. When I say that, they're saying it would be good for your child to see the other parent, and the law requires it. Many parents, if they didn't respond to a counselor, the judge is a figure of authority sitting up there on a bench, they get the message. They get more of a message than they do from an educational program, which And the judge will say, look, this is what you should be doing. Go and see these counselors so that they can be exhorted into having that relationship. Sometimes judges, for example, put in their order saying, I'm ordering, you know, various things, including you shall not make derogatory comments about the other parents in the presence of the child. And that's a nice message to give to parents. Of course, if you're a lawyer, you think, well, how are we going to enforce that? And the answer is probably not. But it's a nice message. A lot of people obey it. Some of them won't. But be aware of that. Then there's the issue about, well, can judges and should judges make orders for people to go into therapy? And I'll talk a little more. There are various kinds of counseling programs, either for the children and or the parents. And I think there's certainly a role for court-ordered therapy, and certainly judges do that. However, I would caution that the research about this for alienation cases is that therapy can work if people want it to work, which is probably true about every kind of situation. But in particular, if the judge says, look, I want this to happen, and if it doesn't happen and is effective, I'm going to change residency of the child, and mom thinks, you know what, if I don't go into this and change, I'm going to lose the kids. So she engages. So she's been coerced into engagement. Can that work? Yes. But if you say you have to go to counseling every week, or you and the kids go every week or whatever, and she's sitting there saying, well, I'll go because that's what the judge is saying, but really I don't want to see change, you're not going to see change. And one sort of benchmark here, it's not a perfect one, is if you as a judge don't see significant change after 6 months of counseling, you're not going to see change at all. This is not a problem that people can be counseled out of unless they're willing to do that. Now, for sure, if they're willing, or for example, if you're the alienated parent, having therapy for the kids if they're changing residence can be very valuable. I'm not saying there's no role for mental health professionals. Far from it. But you can't counsel people out of alienation if they're resistant to that. Now, contempt of court is used very little in Australia, I think, in these kinds of cases. We use it in Canada, by the way, more than you do here. It's not very effective. I mean, the reality is to say, okay, and we had a case, the judge says, look, you haven't had visitation going on. Next weekend you're going to jail for 5 days. And so mom says to the kids, look, you're going to see your dad this weekend, as it so happens, because I'm going to jail this weekend. I mean, it's not a very happy situation. She becomes martyr-like. It doesn't really work very well. And, in fact, I think the judges in Canada who use this probably find the most effective thing to say, I'm finding you in contempt of court, but I don't want you to go to jail right away. I want you to think about it for the next 3 months. And while you're thinking about that, I want these visits to occur, you know, at the specified times. If they don't, when you come back here, bring your toothbrush because you're going for a long time. And, again, you can kind of move a lot of people that way, but not everybody. Some people you find, and then you have the question, is the judge, do you send them to jail now, or what do you do? Police involvement, you do have recovery orders, and I think that these can be, in an interim basis, they can be effective, again, as a threat. I think, and the police can, I mean, they can come on Friday night there with their gun, and I'm sure some of you know, or are police officers. They didn't go to police college, you know, so that they could drag six-year-olds off on visits on Friday night. They don't like doing it. And, of course, it's quite traumatic for the child to have this great big guy with a gun come and drag him away. And so here you have judges saying, well, we're not going to do this on an ongoing basis, but we might do it on an interim basis to see if it works. Another issue is involving what is called Department of Child Protection. I think it's state, of course, has a different name, but can you involve the child welfare authorities? And in a lot of these cases, the child welfare authorities have already been involved, particularly investigating allegations of sexual abuse. My sense in Australia is, across the country, they're very reluctant to do more than their statutory minimum here. There are judgments where the judge says, this is emotional abuse, what's happened to the child, within the context of child protection legislation. And the child protection authorities say, well, we're not doing anything, really. There have been cases where judges have tried to involve them, not very successfully here. I say in Canada we probably have a little more success in judges pushing the Children's Aid Society, but partly because in Canada we have a unified child, if the courts where you go, the case goes, child protection cases and domestic cases go to the same judge. And so they know, if we don't do what the judge says in this case, when we get the child protection, he's not going to be very happy with us, so they tend to have some sway. I think in the more serious cases, really the only remedy that's going to remove people is changing residence. And this has been referred to as the Stark Dilemma. Do I leave the children with the alienating parent, or do I move? And it can be very dramatic, of course. Clearly, these are very difficult cases. They require a comparing of parent incapacity, asking both questions, how bad is the alienated parent? And sometimes they may present well as loving and so on, but you're saying, how personality disordered are they? How are they functioning? How is the child functioning with them? And on the other side, can the rejected parent actually realistically take over custody of the child? There may be constraints based on, dad is working in the Navy and he wants to see the kids, but he's not around a lot, so we can't change residence. He may be a loving, good dad, but when you look at the situation, he's not going to be able to really handle these kids because they're so rejecting. But we certainly see cases where judges do change residence, we found in this study there were a lot of cases where the judge says no alienation, but if he does or she does find alienation, in half the case they reverse custody. This, by the way, is similar to Canadian data. Not in England, they have a much lower rate. They've been much more lucky. England has done a terrible job of alienation cases, I personally think, and I mean, I said that I was there. I probably softened the word terrible, but very problematic. And I should say that they're changing their approach very dramatically. You may know that they're bringing new legislation and they recognize. And a big issue there is delay and so on as well. If there's going to be a change in residence, it's certainly a dramatic step how to do that. I think that in some cases, you're just going to change the primary residence. In some cases, particularly on an interim basis, you may have to stop contact with the alienating parent if it's very serious alienation that's going on. Some judges say, well, maybe can we send the child to foster care in between? That's very problematic. I would say, and of course, each case is unique, but generally speaking, if you're going to change residence, do it quickly, a slow train change. Is the alienating parent just going to undermine that? Maybe it's going to be done on an interim basis just to see how it works out. Certainly maintaining judicial control and reviewing the case is going to be very important. Another side to this is recognizing that there will be cases in which contact cannot be enforced. Even though one can say this is a situation of alienation, not justified rejection, a judge may say at a point in time, it's too intrusive in this family, it's too emotionally intense for this child to try to enforce contact. And the only thing I could do here is change residence, I'm not going to do that. And my argument would be, when you realize that as a judge, you can threaten something, say, I'm going to change residence, or I'm going to send you to jail. You can make the threat once, but if you don't follow through on that, and maybe you should, then change residence, but if you don't, you might as well say, I'm not going to be able to enforce contact. This is I realize this is a tremendous loss for the contact parent, but judges have, we only have limited, there's a reality there. Courts can only do two things with people. They can send them to jail, and they can take away their property. And that's really all judges can do. So when somebody says, why doesn't the judge make sure that visitation, the judge can say, if visitation doesn't occur, I'll send mom to jail. Is that what you want me to do? Or I can seize her property. But I can't change her behavior. I can't get there are just limited things we can do. So there are certainly things that when that is done, one can, as a judge, say, I want to make sure that there's going to be continuing contact. There may be things like social media and Facebook pages and so on to ensure, make sure that report cards are sent. And to take some comfort from the fact that in some of the cases, when the court system backs off, children will not immediately, but over a period of time, may start to visit again. Like there may be a sort of developmental issue here. The kid's 12 years old in the middle of adolescent rebellion saying, I'm not doing what dad says, and I'm not doing what the judge says either. Maybe he says, well, look, it's up to you. He spends a little time with mom. Maybe he says, okay, I'm going to go and see dad. But there are risks on this side as well. And, I was out in Perth, some of you maybe, how many of you heard of the case in Dongara? It's a terrible case out in Perth. With the alienation going on, dad kind of steps back and says, there's three kids. Dad steps back and said, this is all in the newspapers. Dad steps back and says, I'm not going to try to enforce visitation, let mom. Mom sort of mentally, her health, mental health goes down, and she ends up shortly after, killing her, the two girls in her care and herself. Clearly there's a mental health issue there as well, but it was laid on top of an alienation case. So, and I know you've had, of course, terrible, terrible, you know, domestic violence tragedy. You say, well, you know, if we let abusive dad have the kid, he might kill the child, and that's true. The other side of it is if it's a bad enough situation of alienation, you can have tragic outcomes as well. And there are cases of, you know, children who are in those situations committing suicide and so on. So it's, these are very difficult decisions. And I'm not saying certainly, you know, in these cases, one of the concerns that I have is sometimes our politicians, certainly in Canada, but also yours, are driven by, you know, the case that's on the front page of the paper, that's one we have to respond to. Well, and say, we'll pass a law and deal with that. I think that's very problematic sometimes. But it does show the difficulty of these cases. I also think, by the way, it's very unfair. What we tend to do is the media says, who was the very last person to have dealt with that case? So you find out there were, like, you know, 40 professionals involved and, you know, different, all kinds of, so who was the last one to, that's the one we're going to sort of put on the front page. Like, why didn't you do a better job? So anyway. So how, where do I think you should be going with this? Well, and we as well in Canada, we certainly, we may be a little better ahead in some of these, but they're very, recognize the challenge of these cases for everybody, including the courts. One of the things about these litigants are often very high energy, manipulative people who will, of course, be complaining if they don't get what they want. They're complaining to the Law Society, to the Judicial Council, and so on. And certainly, you know, one of the ways and part of dealing with this is there has to be a recognition in society of both need to have a non-adversarial system in general, but also, and on the other side, recognizing that there is an important role for the courts here, and some of these cases have to get in courts more quickly. Alienation, and for that matter, even justified rejection, because it's often related to spousal abuse, are cases that should be in the courts more quickly. If, you know, when we're talking about mental health interventions, counseling, it's more likely to work in an earlier stage before the problem becomes entrenched. This is not a problem that gets better over time. So getting these cases into court, identifying them, and getting into court more quickly, when they're in court, having the judge identify with proper evidence, this is an alienation case, and using the reality, the threat of a change in custody, and if necessary, doing it again more quickly. Certainly one aspect of this is, in terms of the court system, is saying, do we have appropriate counseling services that we can make orders and referrals to, including having a response back and reporting back to the court system. So in some jurisdictions, there's a program in Edmonton, Alberta, I'll give the site later on, where the judge can say, I think there's alienation going on here. I am ordering counseling to go on, and the counselors are to report back to the court. This is confidential as against the world, but as against me, I'm going to get a summary back about what's going on, and I want to hear this progress. And the judge gives the message. And certainly, this seems to be effective, but it's very expensive. I mean, there are several of the parents are paying for it, but seeing the court-directed control over the process, certainly maintaining judicial control, saying, I'm your judge and I'm going to deal with this case until it's resolved, that kind of judicial continuity. There are some innovative programs in the United States. One, and these have been written up, and I have the sites again. One is a program called Overcoming Barriers, where assuming they'll go, they send mom and dad and the children to a summer camp-like program for 5 days, where the kids are both sort of doing stuff and then having various kinds of counseling. This seems to be working really well. The problem is, again, very expensive. And will mom and dad actually go to the same place? But it can be quite dramatic effects. If you can get them both to the same place, it's interesting, the literature about this, how some of these cases that can turn around pretty quickly in that environment. Another program, Dr. Richard Warshak. How many of you have heard of Warshak? So Warshak has an interesting program, and again, he has had some success. He has some books and DVDs that can be used for families that are involved in this situation. In his program, and we've used this in Ontario, the judge says, I'm ordering the kids to go to live with dad after being with the mom because they're alienated, and you can use Warshak's program. Get the kids on an airplane and fly from Toronto to Florida, which is like 3 hours, to go to Disney World, and the kids will be there in Disney World, and they'll play, you know, with dad in the daytime, and they'll have sort of counseling in the mid-sized time breaks and in the evening and so on. So Warshak is there for, you know, whatever it is, $20,000 a week, and they're paying for Disney World. And so, again, is this realistic for most families? Absolutely not. Does it work pretty well? Yeah, it does. And so there are things that can be done if you have the resources, but it's not for everybody. Generally, and those of you who work with parents, these are just two, you know, I think are the better books. Ben Garber, a mental health professional in the United States. And again, you'll get all the PowerPoints and the sites there. Bill Eddy has done nice work. Has Bill Eddy been here? He's been, anyway. There are a number of books that are really quite helpful for parents, whether they're the alienating parents or the alienated, to try to understand the dynamics and work with themselves. So at the high end, you have Warshak for $20 a week. At the low end, you can have Garber for $20 a book. Certainly in terms of family proceedings, you know, the desire here is going to be Australia in many ways is a real world leader in not only research but in your family justice system. You have more resources than most places, but a concern that I certainly have, and I'm from the outside, so you know maybe it's not accurate, but there's a lot of delay, particularly delay in even getting to court, and that's generally speaking appropriate. But you have to have a way of identifying cases like this, getting them before the courts more quickly, and then maintaining judicial control over them. And certainly there's a role here in improving the collaboration between the legal system and the mental health system. This is not a problem that judges alone can deal with. They need mental health professionals to identify the issues and then to provide appropriate intervention. Said judges can't change people's behavior. Mental health professionals can have a role in changing many people's behavior. So, I've spoken for just an hour.
Perfect timing.
So thank you very much.